down next to me. "Are you okay?" "I am concussed," I said. Takumi sat down with me and looked me in the eye. "Do you know what happened to you?" "The beast got me." "Do you know where you are?" "I'm on a triple and a half date." "You're fine," Takumi said. "Let's go." And then I leaned forward and threw up onto Lara's pants. I can't say why I didn't lean backward or to the side. I leaned forward and aimed my mouth toward her jeans. A nice butt-flattering pair of jeans, the kind of pants a girl wears when she wants to look nice but not look like she's trying to look nice. And I threw up all over them. Mostly peanut butter, but also, clearly, some corn.
"Oh,"
she said, surprised and slightly horrified.
"Oh, God," I said. "I'm so sorry."
"I think you might have a concussion," Takumi said, as if the idea had never been suggested.
"I am suffering from the nausea and dizziness typically associated with a mild concussion," I recited.
While Takumi went to get the eagle and Lara changed pants, I lay on the concrete sidewalk. The eagle came back with the school nurse, who diagnosed me with, get this, a concussion, and then Takumi drove me to the hospital with Lara riding shotgun. Apparently, I lay in the back and slowly repeated the words, "the symptoms generally associated with concussion." So I spent my date at the hospital with Lara and Takumi. The doctor told me to go home and sleep a lot, but to make sure and have someone wake me up every 4 hours or so. I vaguely remember Lara standing in the doorway, the room dark and the outside dark and everything mild and comfortable, but sort of spinny, the world pulsing as if from a heavy bass beat. And I vaguely remember Lara smiling at me from the doorway, the glittering ambiguity of a girl's smile, which seems to promise an answer to the question but never gives it. The question, the one we've all been asking since girls stopped being gross, the question that is too simple to be uncomplicated. Does she like me or like me? And then I fell deeply, endlessly asleep, and slept until 3 in the morning when the colonel woke me up.
"She dumped me," he said. "I am concussed," I responded.
"So I heard, hence my waking you up. Video game?"
"Okay, but keep it on mute. My head hurts."
"Yeah, heard you puked on Lara. Very suave."
"Dumped?" I asked, getting up.
"Yeah. Sarah told Jake that I had a hard-on for Alaska. Those words, in that order. And I was like, well, I don't have a hard-on for anything at this moment. You can check if you'd like." And Sarah thought I was being too glib, I suppose, because then she said she knew for a fact I'd hooked up with Alaska, which incidentally is ridiculous. I don't cheat, he said. And finally, the game finished loading, and I half listened as I drove a stock car in circles around a silent track in Talladega. The circles nauseated me, but I kept at it.
"So Alaska went ballistic, basically."
He affected Alaska's voice then, making it more shrill and headache-inducing than it actually was.
"No woman should ever lie about another woman. You've violated the sacred covenant between women. How will stabbing one another in the back help women to rise above patriarchal oppression?" And so on. And then Jake came to Alaska's defense, saying that she would never cheat because she loved him. And then I was like, "Don't worry about Sarah. She just likes bullying people." And then Sarah asked me why I never stood up for her, and somewhere in there, I called her a crazy bitch, which didn't go over particularly well. And then the waitress asked us to leave, and so we were standing in the parking lot, and she said, "I've had enough." And I just stared at her, and she said, "Our relationship is over." He stopped talking then. "Our relationship is over?" I repeated. I felt very spacey, and thought it was just best to repeat the last phrase of whatever the colonel said so he could keep talking.
"Yeah, so that's it. You know what's lame, Pudge? I really care about her. I mean, we were hopeless, badly matched, but still. I mean, I said I loved her. I lost my virginity to her."
"You lost your virginity to her?"
"Yeah, yeah. I never told you that? She's the only girl I've slept with. I don't know. Even though we fought like 94% of the time, I'm really sad."
"You're really sad?" Sadder than I thought I'd be, anyway. I mean, I knew it was inevitable. We haven't had a pleasant moment this whole year. Ever since I got here, I mean, we were just on each other relentlessly. I should have been nicer to her. I don't know. It's sad. It is sad, I repeated. I mean, it's stupid to miss someone you didn't even get along with. But I don't know, it was nice, you know, having someone you could always fight with. Fighting, I said, and then, confused, barely able to drive, I added, is nice.
Right. I don't know what I'll do now. I mean, it was nice to have her. I'm a mad guy, Pudge. What do I do with that?
You can fight with me, I said. I put my controller down and leaned back on our foam couch and was asleep. As I drifted off, I heard the colonel say, I can't be mad at you, you harmless, skinny bastard. 84 days before. 3 days later, the rain began. My head still hurt, and the sizable knot above my left temple looked, the colonel thought, like a miniaturized topographical map of Macedonia, which I had not previously known was a place, let alone a country. And as the colonel and I walked over the parched, half-dead grass that Monday, I said, I suppose we could use some rain. And the colonel looked up at the low clouds coming in fast and threatening, and then he said, well, use it or not, we're sure as shit gonna get some. And we sure as shit did. 20 minutes into French class, Madame O'Malley was conjugating the verb to believe in the subjunctive. Que je crois. Que tu crois. Qu'il ou qu'elle croit. She said it over and over, like it wasn't a verb so much as a Buddhist mantra. Que je crois. Que tu crois. Qu'il ou qu'elle croit. What a funny thing to say over and over again. I would believe. You would believe. He or she would believe. Believe what? I thought. And right then, the rain came. It came all at once, and in a furious torrent, like God was mad and wanted to flood us out. Day after day, night after night, it rained. It rained so that I couldn't see across the dorm circle, so that the lake swelled up and lapped against the Adirondack swing, swallowing half of the fake beach. By the third day, I abandoned my umbrella entirely and walked around in a perpetual state of wetness. Everything at the cafeteria tasted like the minor acid of rainwater, and everything stank of mildew, and showers became ludicrously inappropriate because the whole goddamn world had better water pressure than the showers. And the rain made hermits of us all. The colonel spent every not-in-class moment sitting on the couch, reading the almanac and playing video games, and I wasn't sure whether he wanted to talk or whether he just wanted to sit on the white foam and drink his ambrosia in peace. After the disaster that was our date, I felt it best not to speak to Lara under any circumstances, lest I suffer a concussion and or an attack of puking, even though she told me in pre-calc the next day that it was no big deal. And I saw Alaska only in class and could never talk to her because she came to every class late and left the moment the bell rang, before I could even cap my pen and close my notebook. On the fifth evening of the rain, I walked into the cafeteria, fully prepared to go back to my room and eat a reheated bofrito for dinner if Alaska and or Takumi weren't eating. I knew full well the colonel was in room 43, dining on milk and vodka. But I stayed, because I saw Alaska sitting alone, her back to a rain-streaked window. I grabbed a heaping plate of fried okra and sat down next to her. God, it's like it'll never end, I said, referring to the rain. Indeed, she said. Her wet hair hung from her head and mostly covered her face. I ate some. She ate some. Have you been? I finally asked. I'm really not up for answering any questions that start with how, when, where, why, or what. What's wrong? I asked. That's a what. I'm not doing what's right now. All right, I should go. She pursed her lips and exhaled slowly, like the way the colonel blew out smoke. What? Then I stopped myself and reworded. Did I do something? I asked. She gathered her tray and stood up before answering. Of course not, sweetie. Her sweetie felt condescending, not romantic, like a boy enduring his first biblical rainstorm couldn't possibly understand her problems, whatever they were. It took a sincere effort not to roll my eyes at her, though she wouldn't have even noticed as she walked out of the cafeteria with her hair dripping over her face. 76 days before.
I feel better, the colonel told me on the 9th day of the rainstorm as he sat down next to me in religion class. I had an epiphany. Do you remember that night when she came to the room and was a complete and total bitch?
Yeah, the opera, the flamingo tie.
Right.
What about it? I asked. The colonel pulled out a spiral notebook, the top half of which was soaking wet, and slowly pulled the pages apart until he found his place.
That was the epiphany. She's a complete and total bitch.
Hyde hobbled in, leaning heavily on a black cane. As he made his way toward his chair, he dryly noted,
My trick knee is warning me that we might have some rain, so prepare yourselves.
He stood in front of his chair, leaned back cautiously, grabbed it with both hands, and collapsed into the chair with a series of quick, shallow breaths, like a woman in labor.
Although it isn't due for more than 2 months, you'll be receiving your paper topic for this semester today. Now, I'm quite sure that you've all read the syllabus for this class with such frequency and seriousness that by now you've committed it to memory.
He smirked.
But a reminder. This paper is 50% of your grade. I encourage you to take it seriously. Now, about this Jesus fellow.
Hyde talked about the Gospel of Mark, which I hadn't read until the day before, even though I was a Christian, I guess. I'd been to church, like 4 times, which is more frequently than I'd been to a mosque or a synagogue. He told us that in the 1st century, around the time of Jesus, some of the Roman coins had a picture of the Emperor Augustus on them, and that beneath his picture were inscribed the words, Filius Dei, the Son of God.
We are speaking, he said, of a time in which gods had sons. It was not so unusual to be a son of God. The miracle, at least in that time and in that place, was that Jesus, a peasant, a Jew, a nobody in an empire ruled exclusively by somebodies, was the son of that God, the all-powerful God of Abraham and Moses. That God's son was not an emperor, not even a trained rabbi, a peasant and a Jew, a nobody like you. While the Buddha was special because he abandoned his wealth and noble birth to seek enlightenment, Jesus was special because he lacked wealth and noble birth, but inherited the ultimate nobility, King of Kings.
Class over. You can pick up a copy of your final exam on the way out. Stay dry.
It wasn't until I stood up to leave that I noticed Alaska had skipped class. How could she skip the only class worth attending? I grabbed a copy of the final for her. The final exam. What is the most important question human beings must answer? Choose your question wisely, and then examine how Islam, Buddhism, and Christianity attempt to answer it.
I hope that poor bastard lives the rest of the school year, the colonel said as we jogged home through the rain, because I'm sure starting to enjoy that class. What's your most important question?
After 30 seconds of running, I was already winded. What happens to us when we die?
Christ. Pudge, if you don't stop running, you're going to find out.
He slowed to a walk.
My question is, why do good people get rotten lots in life? Holy shit, is that Alaska?
She was running at us full speed, and she was screaming, but I couldn't hear her over the pounding rain until she was so close to us that I could see her spit flying.
The fuckers flooded my room! They ruined like 100 of my books! Goddamn pissant weekday warrior shit!
Colonel, they poked a hole in the gutter and connected a plastic tube from the gutter down through my back window into my room. The whole place is soaking wet. My copy of The General and His Labyrinth is absolutely ruined.
That's pretty good, the colonel said, like an artist admiring another's work.
Hey! She shouted.
Sorry. Don't worry, dude, he said. God will punish the wicked. And before he does, We will.
"67 days before. So this is how Noah felt. You wake up one morning, and God has forgiven you, and you walk around squinting all day because you've forgotten how sunlight feels, warm and rough against your skin, like a kiss on the cheek from your dad, and the whole world is brighter and cleaner than ever before, like Central Alabama has been put in the washing machine for 2 weeks and cleaned with extra super-strength detergent with color brightener, and now the grass is greener and the burritos are crunchier. I stayed by the classrooms that afternoon, lying on my stomach in the newly dry grass and reading for American history, the Civil War, or, as it was known around these parts, the war between the states. To me, it was the war that spawned 1,000 good last words. Like General Albert Sidney Johnston, who, when asked if he was injured, answered, "Yes, and I fear seriously." Or Robert E. Lee, who, many years after the war, in a dying delirium, announced, "Strike the tent!" I was mulling over why the Confederate generals had better last words than the Union ones. Ulysses S. Grant's last word, "water," was pretty lame, when I noticed a shadow blocking me from the sun. It had been some time since I'd seen a shadow, and it startled me a bit. I looked up. "I brought you a snack," Takumi said, dropping an oatmeal cream pie onto my book. "Very nutritious," I smiled. "You've got your oats, you've got your meal, you've got your cream. It's a fucking food pyramid." "Hell yeah, it is." And then I didn't know what to say. Takumi knew a lot about hip-hop. I knew a lot about last words and video games. Finally, I said, "I can't believe those guys flooded Alaska's room." "Yeah," Takumi said, not looking at me. "Well, they had their reasons. You have to understand that, with like everybody, even the weekday warriors, Alaska is famous for pranking. I mean, last year we put a Volkswagen Beetle in the library. So if they have a reason to try and one-up her, they'll try. And that's pretty ingenious, to divert water from the gutter to her room. I mean, I don't want to admire it." I laughed. "Yeah, that will be tough to top." I unwrapped the cream pie and bit into it. Hundreds of delicious calories per bite. "She'll think of something," he said. "Pudge," he said. "Pudge, you need a cigarette. Let's go for a walk." I felt nervous, as I invariably do when someone says my name twice with a "hmm" in between. But I got up, leaving my books behind, and walked toward the smoking hole. But as soon as we got to the edge of the woods, Takumi turned away from the dirt road. "Not sure the hole is safe," he said. "Not safe," I thought. "It's the safest place to smoke a cigarette in the known universe." But I just followed him through the thick brush, weaving through pine trees and threatening chest-high brambly bushes. After a while, he just sat down. I cupped my hand around my lighter to protect the flame from the slight breeze and lit up. "Alaska ratted out Mariah," he said, "so the eagle might know about the smoking hole, too. I don't know. I've never seen him down that way, but who knows what she told him." "Wait, how do you know?" I asked, dubious. "Well, for one thing, I figured it out. And for another, Alaska admitted it. She told me at least part of the truth, that right at the end of school last year, she tried to sneak off campus one night after lights out to go visit Jake, and then got busted. She said she was careful, no headlights or anything, but the eagle caught her. And she had a bottle of wine in her car, so she was fucked. And the eagle took her into his house and gave her the same offer he gives to everyone when they get fatally busted. Either tell me everything you know or go to your room and pack up your stuff. So Alaska broke and told him that Mariah and Paul were drunk and in her room right then. And then she told him God knows what else. And so the eagle let her go because he needs rats to do his job. She was smart, really, to rat on one of her friends because no one ever thinks to blame the friends. That's why the colonel is so sure it was Kevin and his boys. I didn't believe it could be Alaska either, until I figured out that she was the only person on campus who could have known what Mariah was doing. I suspected Paul's roommate, Longwell, one of the guys who pulled the armless mermaid bit on you. Turns out he was at home that night. His aunt had died. I checked the obit in the paper. Hollis Burness Chase, hell of a name for a woman. So the colonel doesn't know? I asked, stunned. I put out my cigarette, even though I wasn't quite finished, because I felt spooked. I'd never suspected Alaska could be disloyal. Moody, yes, but not a rat. No, and he can't know, because he'll go crazy and get her expelled. The colonel takes all this honor and loyalty shit pretty seriously, if you haven't noticed. I've noticed. Takumi shook his head, his hands pushing aside leaves to dig into the still wet dirt beneath. I just don't get why she'd be so afraid of getting expelled. I'd hate to get expelled, but you have to take your lumps. I don't get it. Well, she obviously doesn't like home. True, she only goes home over Christmas in the summer when Jake is there. But whatever. I don't like home either, but I'd never give the eagle the satisfaction. Takumi picked up a twig and dug it into the soft red dirt. Listen, Pudge, I don't know what kind of prank Alaska and the Colonel are going to come up with to end this, but I'm sure we'll both be involved. I'm telling you all this so you can know what you're getting into, because if you get caught, you had better take it. I thought of Florida, of my school friends, and realized for the first time how much I would miss the creek if I ever had to leave it. I stared down at Takumi's twig sticking erect out of the mud and said, I swear to God I won't rat. I finally understood that day at the jury. Alaska wanted to show us that we could trust her. Survival at Culver Creek meant loyalty, and she had ignored that. But then she'd shown me the way. She and the colonel had taken the fall for me to show me how it was done, so I would know what to do when the time came. 58 days before. About a week later, I woke up at 6:30. 6:30 on a Saturday, to the sweet melody of decapitation. Automatic gunfire blasted out above the menacing bass-heavy background music of the video game. I rolled over and saw Alaska pulling the controller up and to the right, as if that would help her escape certain death. I had the same bad habit.
Can you at least mute it?
Pudge, she said, faux condescending, the sound is an integral part of the artistic experience of this video game. Muting decapitation would be like reading only every other word of Jane Eyre. The colonel woke up about half an hour ago. He seemed a little annoyed, so I told him to go sleep in my room.
Maybe I'll join him, I said groggily.
Then she remarked, so I heard Takumi told you. Yeah, I ratted out Mariah, and I'm sorry, and I'll never do it again. In other news, are you staying here for Thanksgiving? Because I am. I rolled back toward the wall and pulled the comforter over my head. I didn't know whether to trust Alaska, and I'd certainly had enough of her unpredictability. Cold one day, sweet the next. Irresistibly flirty one moment, resistibly obnoxious the next. I preferred the colonel. At least when he was cranky, he had a reason. In a testament to the power of fatigue, I managed to fall asleep quickly, convinced that the shrieking of dying monsters and Alaska's delighted squeals upon killing them were nothing more than a pleasant soundtrack by which to dream. I woke up half an hour later when she sat down on my bed, her butt against my hip. Her underwear, her jeans, the comforter, my corduroys, and my boxers between us, I thought. 5 layers, and yet I felt it, the nervous warmth of touching. A pale reflection of the fireworks of one mouth on another, but a reflection nonetheless. And in the almostness of the moment, I cared at least enough. I wasn't sure whether I liked her, and I doubted whether I could trust her, but I cared at least enough to try to find out. Her on my bed, wide green eyes staring down at me. The enduring mystery of her sly, almost smirking smile. 5 layers between us. She continued as if I hadn't been asleep. Jake has to study, so he doesn't want me in Nashville. Says he can't pay attention to musicology while staring at me. I said I would wear a burqa, but he wasn't convinced, so I'm staying here. I'm sorry, I said. Oh, don't be. I'll have loads to do. There's a prank to plan. But I was thinking you should stay here, too. In fact, I have composed a list. A list? She reached into her pocket and pulled out a heavily folded piece of notebook paper and began to read. Why Pudge Should Stay at the Creek for Thanksgiving, a list by Alaska Young. 1. Because he is a very conscientious student. Pudge has been deprived of many wonderful Culver Creek experiences, including, but not limited to, A. drinking wine with me in the woods, and B, getting up early on a Saturday to eat breakfast at McInedible, and then driving through the Greater Birmingham area smoking cigarettes and talking about how pathetically boring the Greater Birmingham area is, and also C, going out late at night and lying in the dewy soccer field and reading a Kurt Vonnegut book by moonlight. 2. Although she certainly does not excel at endeavors such as teaching the French language, Madame O'Malley makes a mean stuffing, and she invites all the students who stay on campus to Thanksgiving dinner, which is usually just me and the South Korean exchange student, but whatever, Pudge would be welcome. 3. I don't really have a 3, but 1 and 2 were awfully good. 1 and 2 appealed to me, certainly, but mostly I liked the idea of just her and just me on campus. I'll talk to my parents once they wake up, I said. She coaxed me onto the couch, and we played decapitation together until she abruptly dropped the controller. I'm not flirting, I'm just tired, she said, kicking off her flip-flops. She pulled her feet onto the foam couch, tucking them behind a cushion, and scooted up to put her head in my lap. My corduroys, my boxers. 2 layers. I could feel the warmth of her cheek on my thigh. There are times when it's appropriate, even preferable, to get an erection when someone's face is in close proximity to your penis. This was not one of those times. So I stopped thinking about the layers and the warmth, muted the TV, and focused on decapitation. At 8:30, I turned off the game and scooted out from underneath Alaska. She turned onto her back, still asleep, the lines of my corduroy pants imprinted on her cheek. I usually only called my parents on Sunday afternoons, so when my mom heard my voice, she instantly overreacted. What's wrong, Miles? Are you okay? I'm fine, Mom. I think if it's okay with you, I think I might stay here for Thanksgiving. A lot of my friends are staying, lie, and I have a lot of work to do, double lie. I had no idea how hard the classes would be, Mom, truth. Oh, sweetie, we miss you so much, and there's a big Thanksgiving turkey waiting for you, and all the cranberry sauce you can eat. I hated cranberry sauce, but for some reason my mom persisted in her lifelong belief that it was my very favorite food, even though every single Thanksgiving I politely declined to include it on my plate. I know, Mom, I miss you guys too, but I really want to do well here, truth. And plus, it's really nice to have, like, friends. Truth. I knew that playing the friend card would sell her on the idea, and it did. So I got her blessing to stay on campus after promising to hang out with them for every minute of Christmas break, as if I had other plans. I spent the morning at the computer, flipping back and forth between my religion and English papers. There were only 2 weeks of classes before exams, the coming one and the one after Thanksgiving, and so far the best personal answer I had to what happens to people after they die was, well, something. Maybe. The colonel came in at noon, his thick uber-math book cradled in his arms. I just saw Sarah, he said. How'd that work out for you? Bad. She said she still loved me. God, I love you really is the gateway drug of breaking up. Saying I love you while you're walking across the dorm circle inevitably leads to saying I love you while you're doing it, so I just bolted. I laughed. He pulled out a notebook and sat down at his desk. Yeah, ha ha. So Alaska says you're staying here. Yeah, I feel a little guilty about ditching my parents, though. Yeah, well, if you're staying here in hopes of making out with Alaska, I sure wish you wouldn't. If you unmoor her from the rock that is Jake, God have mercy on us all. That would be some drama indeed, and as a rule, I like to avoid drama. It's not because I want to make out with her. Hold on. He grabbed a pencil and scrawled excitedly at the paper, as if he'd just made a mathematical breakthrough, and then looked back up at me. I just did some calculations, and I've been able to determine that you're full of shit. And he was right. How could I abandon my parents, who were nice enough to pay for my education at Culver Creek? My parents who had always loved me, just because I maybe liked some girl with a boyfriend? How could I leave them alone with a giant turkey and mounds of inedible cranberry sauce? So during third period, I called my mom at work. I wanted her to say it was okay, I guess, for me to stay at the creek for Thanksgiving, but I didn't quite expect her to excitedly tell me that she and Dad had bought plane tickets to England immediately after I called and were planning to spend Thanksgiving in a castle on their second honeymoon. Oh, that's awesome, I said, and then quickly got off the phone because I did not want her to hear me cry. I guess Alaska heard me slam down the phone from her room because she opened the door as I turned away but said nothing. I walked across the dorm circle and then straight through the soccer fields, bushwhacking through the woods, until I ended up on the banks of Culver Creek, just down from the bridge. I sat with my butt on a rock and my feet in the dark dirt of the creek bed and tossed pebbles into the clear, shallow water, and they landed with an empty plop, barely audible over the rumbling of the creek as it danced its way south. The light filtered through the leaves and pine needles above as if through lace, the ground spotted in shadow. I thought of the one thing about home that I missed, my dad's study, with its built-in floor-to-ceiling shelves sagging with thick biographies, and the black leather chair that kept me just uncomfortable enough to keep from falling asleep as I read. It was stupid to feel as upset as I did. I ditched them, but it felt the other way around. Still, I felt unmistakably homesick. I looked up toward the bridge and saw Alaska sitting on one of the blue chairs at the smoking hole, and though I'd thought I wanted to be alone, I found myself saying, "Hey." Then, when she did not turn to me, I screamed, "Alaska!" She walked over. "I was looking for you," she said, joining me on the rock. "Hey, I'm really sorry, Pudge," she said, and put her arms around me, resting her head against my shoulder. It occurred to me that she didn't even know what had happened, but she still sounded sincere. "What am I going to do?" "You'll spend Thanksgiving with me, silly, here." "So why don't you go home for vacations?" I asked. "I'm just scared of ghosts, Pudge, and home is full of them." 52 days before. After everyone left, after the colonel's mom showed up in a beat-up hatchback and he threw his giant duffel bag into the back seat, and after he said, "I'm not much for saying goodbye. I'll see you in a week. Don't do anything I wouldn't do." And after a green limousine arrived for Lara, whose father was the only doctor in some small town in southern Alabama, and after I joined Alaska on a harrowing we-don't-need-no-stinking-breaks drive to the airport to drop off Takumi, and after the campus settled into an eerie quiet, with no doors slamming and no music playing and no one laughing and no one screaming, after all that, we made our way down to the soccer field, and she took me to the edge of the field where the woods start, the same steps I'd walked on my way to being thrown into the lake. Beneath the full moon, she cast a shadow, and you could see the curve from her waist to her hips in the shadow, and after a while, she stopped and said, "Dig." And I said, "Dig?" And she said, "Dig." And we went on like that for a bit, and then I got on my knees and dug through the soft black dirt at the edge of the woods, and before I could get very far, my fingers scratched glass, and I dug around the glass until I pulled out a bottle of pink wine. Strawberry Hill, it was called, I suppose because if it had not tasted like vinegar with a dash of maple syrup, it might have tasted like strawberries. "I have a fake ID," she said, "but it sucks. So every time I go to the liquor store, I try to buy 10 bottles of this and some vodka for the colonel. And so when it finally works, I'm covered for a semester. And then I give the colonel his vodka, and he puts it wherever he puts it, and I take mine and bury it." "Because you're a pirate," I said. "Aye, matey. Precisely. Although wine consumption has risen a bit this semester, so we'll need to take a trip tomorrow. This is the last bottle." She unscrewed the cap, no corks here, sipped, and handed it to me. "Don't worry about the eagle tonight," she said. "He's just happy most everyone's gone. He's probably masturbating for the first time in a month." I worried about it for a moment as I held the bottle by the neck, but I wanted to trust her, and so I did. I took a minor sip, and as soon as I swallowed, I felt my body rejecting the stinging syrup of it. It washed back up my esophagus, but I swallowed hard, and there, yes, I did it. I was drinking on campus. so we lay in the tall grass between the soccer field and the woods, passing the bottle back and forth and tilting our heads up to sip the wince-inducing wine. As promised in the list, she brought a Kurt Vonnegut book, Cat's Cradle, and she read aloud to me, her soft voice mingling with the frogs croaking and the grasshoppers landing softly around us. I did not hear her words so much as the cadence of her voice. She'd obviously read the book many times before, and so she read flawlessly and confidently, and I could hear her smile in the reading of it. And the sound of that smile made me think that maybe I would like novels better if Alaska Young read them to me. After a while, she put down the book, and I felt warm but not drunk with the bottle resting between us. My chest touching the bottle, and her chest touching the bottle, but us not touching each other. And then she placed her hand on my leg. Her hand just above my knee, the palm flat and soft against my jeans, and her index finger making slow, lazy circles that crept toward the inside of my thigh. And with one layer between us, God, I wanted her. And lying there amid the tall, still grass and beneath the star-drunk sky, listening to the just this side of inaudible sound of her rhythmic breathing and the noisy silence of the bullfrogs, the grasshoppers, the distant cars rushing endlessly on I-65, I thought it might be a fine time to say the three little words. And I steeled myself to say them as I stared up at that starriest night, convinced myself that she felt it too, that her hand, so alive and vivid against my leg, was more than playful. And fuck Lara and fuck Jake, because I do, Alaska Young, I do love you, and what else matters but that? And my lips parted to speak, and before I could even begin to breathe out the words, she said, "It's not life or death, the labyrinth." Okay, so what is it?
"Suffering," she said. "Doing wrong and having wrong things happen to you. That's the problem. Bolivar was talking about the pain, not about the living or dying. How do you get out of the labyrinth of suffering?"
"What's wrong?" I asked, and I felt the absence of her hand on me.
"Nothing's wrong, but there's always suffering, Pudge. Homework, or malaria, or having a boyfriend who lives far away when there's a good-looking boy lying next to you. Suffering is universal. It's the one thing Buddhists, Christians, and Muslims are all worried about."
I turned to her. "Oh, so maybe Dr. Hyde's class isn't total bullshit." And both of us lying on our sides, she smiled, our noses almost touching, my unblinking eyes on hers, her face blushing from the wine, and I opened my mouth again, but this time not to speak. And she reached up and put a finger to my lips and said, "Shh, shh, don't ruin it."
51 days before. The next morning, I didn't hear the knocking, if there was any. I just heard, "Up! Do you know what time it is?" I looked at the clock and groggily muttered, "It's 7:36. "No, Pudge, it's party time. We've only got 7 days left before everyone comes back. Oh, God, I can't even tell you how nice it is to have you here. Last Thanksgiving, I spent the whole time constructing one massive candle using the wax from all my little candles. God, it was boring. Accounting the ceiling tiles. 67 down, 84 across. Talk about suffering. Absolute torture."
"I'm really tired. I said, and then she cut me off.
"Poor Pudge. Oh, poor, poor Pudge. Do you want me to climb into bed with you and cuddle?"
"Well, if you're offering..."
"No! Up! Now!"
She took me behind a wing of weekday warrior rooms, 50 to 59, and stopped in front of a window, placed her palms flat against it, and pushed up until the window was half open, then crawled inside. I followed.
"What do you see, Pudge?"
I saw a dorm room, the same cinder block walls, the same dimensions, even the same layout as my own. Their couch was nicer, and they had an actual coffee table, instead of a trunk labeled coffee table. They had two posters on the wall. One featured a huge stack of $100 bills with the caption, "The first million is the hardest." On the opposite wall, a poster of a red Ferrari.
I see a dorm room."
"You're not looking, Pudge. When I go into your room, I see a couple of guys who love video games. When I look at my room, I see a girl who loves books. She walked over to the couch and picked up a plastic soda bottle. "Look at this," she said, and I saw that it was half filled with a brackish brown liquid, dip spit. "So they dip, and they obviously aren't hygienic about it. So are they going to care if we pee on their toothbrushes? They won't care enough, that's for sure. Look, tell me what these guys love." "They love money," I said, pointing to the poster. She threw up her hands, exasperated. "They all love money, Pudge. Okay, go into the bathroom. Tell me what you see there." The game was annoying me a little, but I went into the bathroom as she sat down on that inviting couch. Inside the shower, I found a dozen bottles of shampoo and conditioner. In the medicine cabinet, I found a cylindrical bottle of something called Rewind. I opened it. The bluish gel smelled like flowers and rubbing alcohol, like a fancy hair salon. Under the sink, I also found a tub of Vaseline so big that it could have only one possible use, which I didn't care to dwell on. I came back into the room and excitedly said, "They love their hair." "Precisely," she shouted. "Look on the top bunk." Perilously positioned on the thin wooden headboard of the bed, a bottle of Stay Wet gel. "Kevin doesn't just wake up with that spiky bedhead look, Pudge. He works for it. He loves that hair. They leave their hair products here, Pudge, because they have duplicates at home. All those boys do, and do you know why?" "Because they're compensating for their tiny little penises?" I asked. "Ha ha, no. That's why they're macho assholes. They love their hair because they aren't smart enough to love something more interesting. So we hit them where it hurts. The scalp." "Okay," I said, unsure of how exactly to prank someone's scalp. She stood up and walked to the window and bent over to shimmy out. "Don't look at my ass," she said, and so I looked at her ass, spreading out wide from her thin waist. She effortlessly somersaulted out the half-opened window. I took the feet-first approach, and once I got my feet on the ground, I limboed my upper body out the window. "Well," she said, "that looked awkward. Let's go to the smoking hole." She shuffled her feet to kick up dry orange dirt on the road to the bridge, seeming not to walk so much as cross-country ski. As we followed the almost trail down from the bridge to the hole, she turned around and looked back at me, stopping. "I wonder how one would go about acquiring industrial-strength blue dye," she said, and then held a tree branch back for me. Forty-9 days before. 2 days later, Monday, the first real day of vacation, I spent the morning working on my religion final and went to Alaska's room in the afternoon. She was reading in bed. "Auden," she announced. "What were his last words?"
"Don't know. Never heard of him."
"Never heard of him? You poor illiterate boy. Here, read this line."
I walked over and looked down at her index finger. "You shall love your crooked neighbor with your crooked heart," I read aloud.
"Yeah, that's pretty good," I said. "Pretty good? Sure, and bufritos are pretty good. Sex is pretty fun. The sun is pretty hot. Jesus, it says so much about love and brokenness. It's perfect."
"Mm-hmm," I nodded unenthusiastically.
"You're hopeless. Want to go porn hunting?"
"Huh?"
"We can't love our neighbors till we know how crooked their hearts are. Don't you like porn?" she asked, smiling.
I answered. The truth was that I hadn't seen much porn, but the idea of looking at porn with Alaska had a certain appeal. We started with the 50s wing of dorms and made our way backward around the hexagon. She pushed open the back windows while I looked out and made sure no one was walking by. I'd never been in most people's rooms. After 3 months, I knew most people, but I regularly talked to very few, just the Colonel and Alaska and Takumi, really. But in a few hours, I got to know my classmates quite well. Wilson Carbot, the center for the Culver Creek Nothings, had hemorrhoids, or at least he kept hemorrhoidal cream secreted away in the bottom drawer of his desk. Chandra Kylers, a cute girl who loved math a little too much and who Alaska believed was the Colonel's future girlfriend, collected Cabbage Patch Kids.
I don't mean that she collected Cabbage Patch Kids when she was like 5. She collected them now. Dozens of them. Black, white, Latino, and Asian, boys and girls, babies dressed like farmhands and budding businessmen. A senior weekday warrior named Holly Moser sketched nude self-portraits in charcoal pencil, portraying her rotund form in all its girth. I was stunned by how many people had booze. Even the weekday warriors, who got to go home every weekend, had beer and liquor stashed everywhere from toilet tanks to the bottoms of dirty clothes hampers. God, I could have ratted out anyone, Alaska said softly as she unearthed a 40-ounce bottle of Magnum malt liquor from Longwell Chase's closet. I wondered then why she had chosen Paul and Mariah. Alaska found everyone's secrets so fast that I suspected she'd done this before. But she couldn't possibly have had advance knowledge of the secrets of Ruth and Margot Blauker, ninth-grade twin sisters who were new and seemed to socialize even less than I did. After crawling into their room, Alaska looked around for a moment, then walked to the bookshelf. She stared at it, then pulled out the King James Bible, and there, a purple bottle of Maui Wowie wine cooler. "How clever," she said as she twisted off the cap. She drank it down in 2 long sips and then proclaimed, "Maui Wowie!" "They'll know you were here," I shouted. Her eyes widened. "Oh, no. You're right, Pudge," she said. "Maybe they'll go to the Eagle and tell him that someone stole their wine cooler." She laughed and leaned out the window, throwing the empty bottle onto the grass. And we found plenty of porn magazines haphazardly stuffed in between mattresses and box springs. It turns out that Hank Walston did like something other than basketball and pot. He liked jugs. But we didn't find a movie until room 32, occupied by a couple of guys from Mississippi named Joe and Marcus. They were in our religion class and sometimes sat with the colonel and me at lunch, but I didn't know them well. Alaska read the sticker on the top of the video. "The bitches of Madison County. Well, ain't that just delightful?" We ran with it to the TV room, closed the blinds, locked the door, and watched the movie. It opened with a woman standing on a bridge with her legs spread, while a guy knelt in front of her, giving her oral sex. No time for dialogue, I suppose. By the time they started doing it, Alaska commenced with her righteous indignation. "They just don't make sex look fun for women. The girl is just an object. Look, look at that." I was already looking, needless to say. A woman crouched on her hands and knees while a guy knelt behind her. She kept saying, "Give it to me," and moaning, and though her eyes, brown and blank, betrayed her lack of interest, I couldn't help but take mental notes. "Hands on her shoulders," I noted. "Fast, but not too fast, or it's going to be over fast. Keep your grunting to a minimum." As if reading my mind, she said, "God, Pudge, never do it that hard. That would hurt. That looks like torture. And all she can do is just sit there and take it? This is not a man and a woman. It's a penis and a vagina. What's erotic about that? Where's the kissing?" "Given their position, I don't think they can kiss right now," I noted. "That's my point. Just by virtue of how they're doing it, it's objectification. He can't even see her face. This is what can happen to women, Pudge. That woman is someone's daughter. This is what you make us do for money." "Well, not me," I said defensively. "I mean, not technically. I don't, like, produce porn movies." "Look me in the eye and tell me this doesn't turn you on, Pudge." I couldn't. She laughed. "It was fine," she said. "Healthy." And then she got up, stopped the tape, lay down on her stomach across the couch, and mumbled something. "What did you say?" I asked, walking to her, putting my hand on the small of her back. "Shh," she said. "I'm sleeping." Just like that. From 100 miles an hour to asleep in a nanosecond. I wanted so badly to lie down next to her on the couch, to wrap my arms around her and sleep. Not fuck, like in those movies, not even have sex, just sleep together, in the most innocent sense of the phrase. But I lacked the courage, and she had a boyfriend. And I was gawky, and she was gorgeous, and I was hopelessly boring, and she was endlessly fascinating. So I walked back to my room and collapsed on the bottom bunk, thinking that if people were rain, I was drizzle, and she was a hurricane.
47 days before. On Wednesday morning, I woke up with a stuffy nose to an entirely new Alabama, a crisp and cold one. As I walked to Alaska's room that morning, the frosty grass of the dorm circle crunched beneath my shoes. You don't run into frost much in Florida, and I jumped up and down like I was stomping on bubble wrap. Crunch, crunch, crunch. Alaska was holding a burning green candle in her hand upside down, dripping the wax onto a larger homemade candle that looked a bit like a Technicolor middle school science project volcano. "Don't burn yourself," I said as the flame crept up toward her hand. "Night falls fast. Today is in the past," she said without looking up. "Wait, I've read that before. What is that?" I asked. With her free hand, she grabbed a book and tossed it toward me. It landed at my feet. "Poem," she said, "Edna St. Vincent Millay." "You've read that? I'm stunned." "Oh, I read her biography. Didn't have her last words in it, though. I was a little bitter. All I remember is that she had a lot of sex." "I know, she's my hero," Alaska said, without a trace of irony. I laughed, but she didn't notice. "Does it seem at all odd to you that you enjoy biographies of great writers a lot more than you enjoy their actual writing?" "Nope," I announced. "Just because they were interesting people doesn't mean I care to hear their musings on nighttime." "It's about depression, dumbass." "Ooh, really? Well, geez, then it's brilliant," I answered. She sighed. "All right. The snow may be falling in the winter of my discontent, but at least I've got sarcastic company. Sit down, will you?" I sat down next to her with my legs crossed and our knees touching. She pulled a clear plastic crate filled with dozens of candles out from underneath her bed. She looked at it for a moment, then handed me a white one and a lighter. We spent all morning burning candles. Well, and occasionally lighting cigarettes off the burning candles, after we stuffed a towel into the crack at the bottom of her door. Over the course of 2 hours, we added a full foot to the summit of her polychrome candle volcano. "Mount St. Helens on acid," she said. At 12:30, after 2 hours of me begging for a ride to McDonald's, Alaska decided it was time for lunch. As we began to walk to the student parking lot, I saw a strange car. A small green car. A hatchback. "I've seen that car," I thought. "Where have I seen the car?" And then the colonel jumped out and ran to meet us. Rather than like, I don't know, hello or something, the colonel began, "I have been instructed to invite you to Thanksgiving dinner at Chez Martin." Alaska whispered into my ear, and then I laughed and said, "I have been instructed to accept your invitation." So we walked over to the Eagle's house, told him we were going to eat turkey trailer park style, and sped away in the hatchback. The colonel explained it to us on the 2-hour car ride south. I was crammed into the back seat because Alaska had called shotgun. She usually drove, but when she didn't, she was shotgun-calling queen of the world. The colonel's mother heard that we were on campus and couldn't bear the thought of leaving us familyless for Thanksgiving. The colonel didn't seem too keen on the whole idea. "I'm going to have to sleep in a tent," he said, and I laughed. Except it turns out he did have to sleep in a tent. A nice 4-person green outfit, shaped like half an egg, but still a tent. The colonel's mom lived in a trailer, as in the kind of thing you might see attached to a large pickup truck. Except this particular one was old and falling apart on its cinder blocks, and probably couldn't have been hooked up to a truck without disintegrating. It wasn't even a particularly big trailer. I could just barely stand up to my full height without scraping the ceiling. Now I understood why the colonel was short. He couldn't afford to be any taller. The place was really one long room with a full-size bed in the front, a kitchenette, and a living area in the back with a TV and a small bathroom, so small that in order to take a shower, you pretty much had to sit on the toilet. "It ain't much," the colonel's mom, "that's Dolores, not Miss Martin," told us. "But y'all's going to have a turkey the size of the kitchen." She laughed. The colonel ushered us out of the trailer immediately after our brief tour, and we walked through the neighborhood, a series of trailers and mobile homes on dirt roads.
"Well, now you get why I hate rich people."
And I did. I couldn't fathom how the colonel grew up in such a small place. The entire trailer was smaller than our dorm room. I didn't know what to say to him, how to make him feel less embarrassed.
"I'm sorry if it makes you uncomfortable," he said. "I know it's probably foreign."
"Not to me," Alaska piped up.
"Well, you don't live in a trailer," he told her.
"Poor is poor."
"I suppose," the colonel said.
Alaska decided to go help Dolores with dinner. She said that it was sexist to leave the cooking to the women, but better to have good sexist food than crappy boy-prepared food. So the colonel and I sat on the pull-out couch in the living room, playing video games and talking about school.
"I finished my religion paper, but I have to type it up on your computer when we get back. I think I'm ready for finals, which is good, since we have an Ankh-Prey to Ankh-Play."
"Your mom doesn't know Pig Latin?" I smirked. "Not if I talk fast. Christ, be quiet." The food, fried okra, steamed corn on the cob, and pot roast that was so tender it fell right off the plastic fork, convinced me that Dolores was an even better cook than Maureen. Culver Creek's okra had more grease, less crunch. Dolores was also the funniest mom I'd ever met. When Alaska asked her what she did for work, she smiled and said, "I'm a culinary engineer. That's a short order cook at the Waffle House to y'all."
"Best Waffle House in Alabama."
The colonel smiled, and then I realized he wasn't embarrassed by his mom at all. He was just scared that we would act like condescending boarding school snobs. I'd always found the colonel's "I hate the rich" routine a little overwrought until I saw him with his mom. He was the same colonel, but in a totally different context. It made me hope that one day I could meet Alaska's family, too. Dolores insisted that Alaska and I share the bed, and she slept on the pullout while the colonel was out in his tent. I worried he would get cold, but frankly, I wasn't about to give up my bed with Alaska. We had separate blankets, and there were never fewer than three layers between us, but the possibilities kept me up half the night. 46 days before. Best Thanksgiving food I'd ever had. No crappy cranberry sauce, just huge slabs of moist white meat, corn, green beans cooked in enough bacon fat to make them taste like they weren't good for you, biscuits with gravy, pumpkin pie for dessert, and a glass of red wine for each of us. "I believe," Dolores said, "that you're supposed to drink white with turkey, but now, I don't know about y'all, but I don't suppose I give a shit." We laughed and drank our wine, and then after the meal, we each listed our gratitudes. My family always did that before the meal, and we all just rushed through it to get to the food. So the four of us sat around the table and shared our blessings. I was thankful for the fine food and the fine company, for having a home on Thanksgiving. "A trailer, at least," Dolores joked.
"Okay, my turn," Alaska said. "I'm grateful for having just had my best Thanksgiving in a decade."
Then the colonel said, "I'm just grateful for you, Mom." And Dolores laughed and said, "That dog won't hunt, boy."
I didn't exactly know what that phrase meant, but it apparently meant that was inadequate, because then the colonel expanded his list to acknowledge that he was grateful to be
the smartest human being in this trailer park. And Dolores laughed and said,
"Good enough."
And Dolores? She was grateful that her phone was back on, that her boy was home, that Alaska helped her cook, and that I had kept the colonel out of her hair, that her job was steady and her co-workers were nice, that she had a place to sleep and a boy who loved her. I sat in the back of the hatchback on the drive home, and that is how I thought of it, home, and fell asleep to the highway's monotonous lullaby. 44 days before.
Coosa Liquor's entire business model is built around selling cigarettes to minors and alcohol to adults.
Alaska looked at me with disconcerting frequency when she drove, particularly since we were winding through a narrow, hilly highway south of school, headed to the aforementioned Coosa Liquor's. It was Saturday, our last day of real vacation.
"Which is great if all you need is cigarettes, but we need booze, and they card for booze, and my ID blows, but I'll flirt my way through."
She made a sudden and unsignaled left turn, pulling onto a road that dropped precipitously down a hill, with fields on either side, and she gripped the steering wheel tight as we accelerated, and she waited until the last possible moment to brake, just before we reached the bottom of the hill. There stood a plywood gas station that no longer sold gas, with a faded sign bolted to the roof. Coosa Liquors,
We cater to your spiritual needs. Alaska went in alone and walked out the door 5 minutes later, weighed down by 2 paper bags filled with contraband, 3 cartons of cigarettes, 5 bottles of wine, and